The nuclear program is the only surviving strategy for North Korea.
North Korea hacks its way to millions. It's Thursday, February 11th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Follow us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, protests continue amid Myanmar crackdown. Donald Trump impeachment trial is underway. Pacific Islands are upset. Virtual reality training. A community cookout. It's all on today's VOA Asia. A United Nations report says North Korea has used cyber attacks to steal hundreds of millions of dollars to fund its nuclear program and ballistic missile capabilities. Henry Ridgewell has more.
The leaked United Nations report says North Korea managed to bolster both its nuclear and missile programs in 2020, despite being subject to a raft of international sanctions. It highlights new ballistic missiles that have been on display in recent parades, which the report says could be large enough to carry nuclear warheads and put the entire United States in range. Pyongyang boasted in January of developing what it claimed to be the world's most powerful weapon, a submarine-launched ballistic missile. The report says North Korea financed the military expansion with $300 million stolen through cyber hacks and online fraud. Sojin Lim is a Korea analyst at the University of Central Lancashire in Britain.
The nuclear program is the only surviving strategy for North Korea, especially for Kim's family's the regime survival. And recently, because of the COVID-19 situation, their economic situation has become even worse. And especially with the new administration in the States, with Biden, the new President Biden, the North Korea has no other way to discuss, to negotiate with the America.
The report was written by independent monitors for the UN Security Council's North Korea Sanctions Committee and leaked to Reuters Tuesday. North Korea is subject to a range of multilateral and unilateral sanctions, but they have not worked, argues Lim.
North Korea has been successful in finding new ways to mobilizing finance. And you know, this cyber attack with this amount of, it's lots of money, then that makes me even convinced that sanctions do not work and we really need to find out new frame to approach to North Korea now.
In the past decade, North Korea has conducted a series of missile and nuclear tests of escalating size. Former US President Donald Trump met North Korean leader Kim Jong-un three times in 2018 and 2019, but the negotiations failed to persuade Pyongyang to give up its nuclear weapons. The new administration under President Joe Biden is working on a new approach. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan spoke to reporters February 4th.
That review is underway and that we will consult closely with our allies, particularly the ROK in Japan, in doing that.
Despite the U.S. pledge of a new approach to Pyongyang, most experts see little hope of imminent progress towards denuclearization of the Korea Peninsula. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News.
You may find much more on our top story by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia. And stop by our website, voanews.com. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. South Korea grants emergency use of controversial AstraZeneca vaccine. Four Thai activists denied bail ahead of next month's trial. Pakistan's top court commutes death sentences of two mentally ill prisoners. China uses rape as torture tactic against Uyghur detainees, according to victims. China records fewer births in 2020 than the previous year. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also stop by our voanews.com website. Demonstrations continued for a fifth straight day as Myanmar's police cracked down on people protesting the country's military coup in the capital, Naypyidaw. They fired warning shots, rubber bullets, and water cannon. At least two demonstrators are reported seriously injured with what are believed to be gunshot wounds. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain tells us more.
Demonstrators took to the streets in Myanmar's capital for the fourth day in a row, defying restrictions imposed by the military junta aimed at stopping massive protests against the overthrow of the elected civilian government, including leader Aung San Suu Kyi. An unnamed physician who treated demonstrators at a hospital told VOA that at least two of them sustained what he believes were gunshot wounds, one to the head, the other to the chest. State Department spokesperson Ned Price again called on the military junta in the country formerly known as Burma to relinquish power and respect the rights of peaceful protesters.
What I would say broadly is that we strongly condemn violence against demonstrators. All individuals in Burma have rights to freedom of expression, association, peaceful assembly, including for the purposes of peaceful protest.
The massive protests defying restrictions are in line with one analyst's expectations.
But in terms of the Myanmar people's sort of spirit and desire to not have this military coup and to have some restoration of democracy, no, I'm not surprised.
Other experts say there is little that the United States can do to influence Myanmar's generals because the head of the junta, Min Aung Hlaing, is already under U.S. sanctions.
He was sanctioned under the Global Magnitsky Act along with other senior generals in 2019 for their ethnic cleansing campaign against the Rohingya. So how do you sanction somebody who's already banned from owning property in the U.S., traveling to the U.S., or doing business with Americans?
Experts say with so little leverage on Myanmar, the best option for the U.S. is to work closely with other countries.
So the U.S. would be one to work with democracies in Europe, Canada, Japan, maybe some of the Southeast Asian countries like Singapore, Indonesia, with India also. So there's definitely going to be a need for multilateralism here because there's no way the U.S. can really affect much policy change in Myanmar by itself.
The State Department's Ned Price said Myanmar has been a constant topic in America's engagement with allies around the world this week. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
The overthrow of Myanmar's democratically elected government by the military last week is drawing international attention to the armed forces' vast but murky business empire as pressure builds on foreign companies to break ties with it. International rebuke of the coup was swift, and by the end of the first week, Japanese beverage giant Kirin announced it was pulling out of a joint venture with a military-owned firm behind the country's most popular brew, Myanmar beer. On Tuesday, RMH Singapore said it would be giving up its shares in Myanmar's Virginia Tobacco Company, another joint venture co-owned by the military. Last week's coup will convince more of the holdouts to follow suit to save their reputations, according to George McLeod, managing partner at Access Asia, which advises firms doing business in the region on risk and brand protection. Since the coup, Amnesty International, Global Witness, and other rights groups have renewed and stepped up their calls for foreign firms to break ties that they have with military-linked enterprises. They are also urging governments to impose targeted sanctions on the generals and their business interests. Happening now in Asia, Indonesian investigators say a malfunctioning automatic throttle may have caused the pilots of the Sriwijaya Air jet to lose control, leading to the Boeing plane's plunge into the Java Sea last month. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. The historic second impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump began in the U.S. Senate on Tuesday, and it continues as we speak. Senators will have to decide if Trump incited the deadly insurrection at the U.S. Capitol a month ago by urging his supporters to confront lawmakers as they were certifying that Democrat Joe Biden had defeated Trump in the 2020 election. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more on the trial taking place on Capitol Hill.
Last month's deadly riot at the U.S. Capitol now leading to a first in U.S. history. A former president under trial in the U.S. Senate.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye.
Trump charged with inciting that mob to riot.
When you catch somebody in a fraud, you're allowed to go by very different rules.
After falsely claiming he won the 2020 election and telling his supporters to fight the certification of Electoral College results for Joe Biden.
The gravest charges ever brought against a president of the United States in American history.
More than 200 people have now been charged in connection with the January 6th riot. A day lawmakers warned will be an inspiration for domestic extremism and presidential abuse of power.
This cannot be the future of America. We cannot have presidents inciting and mobilizing mob violence against our government and our institutions because they refuse to accept the will of the people.
The U.S. National Guard says that by mid-March, it will have spent almost $500 million in additional security for the U.S. Capitol since the January 6th attack. In the trial's first day, Democrats laid out their argument for Trump's guilt.
We will prove with overwhelming evidence that President Trump is singularly and directly responsible for inciting the assault on the Capitol.
And argued Trump must face consequences even though he is no longer president.
Presidents can't inflame insurrection in their final weeks and then walk away like nothing happened.
Conviction requires a two-thirds vote of the U.S. Senate. Assuming all 50 Democrats vote to convict, that means 17 Republican senators would also have to find Trump guilty. If Trump is convicted, senators will vote again to decide if he is barred from ever again running for office. His lawyers argue that was the true reason for what they called a politically motivated impeachment.
For a great many Americans see this process for exactly what it is, a chance by a group of partisan politicians seeking to eliminate Donald Trump from the American political scene and seeking to disenfranchise 74 million plus American voters and those who dare to share their political beliefs and vision of America.
The trial, which resumes Wednesday with 16 hours for each side to present arguments and evidence, will run through at least Sunday. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia, a Japanese maritime self-defense force submarine and a commercial ship have collided off Japan's southern coast, causing minor injuries to three crew members of the submarine and damage to its mast, according to defense officials. You'll find all the big stories through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, New Zealand is urging disaffected Micronesian members of the Pacific Islands Forum not to quit the organization. A bitter leadership dispute has split the region's main political and economic body. From Sydney, Phil Mercer tells us more.
Speaking in the New Zealand's capital, Wellington, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said the decision by Micronesian nations to leave the regional forum was regrettable. Australia, too, has urged the parties to settle differences. Founded in 1971, it has 18 members, including Papua New Guinea, French Polynesia, Samoa, New Zealand, and Australia. Experts believe that Palau, the Marshall Islands, the Federated States of Micronesia, Kiribati, and Nauru feel overlooked by larger Melanesian members like Papua New Guinea and Fiji, which are culturally and geographically different. There is bitter disagreement about who should lead the Pacific Islands Forum. Micronesian states from the North Pacific have insisted an agreement to appoint their preferred candidate as the forum's new Secretary General has been broken. Australia and New Zealand are concerned about regional instability. There's also concern that disunity could encourage China to increase its influence over island nations. The archipelago of Kiribati recently swapped its formal diplomatic recognition from Taiwan to mainland China. Jonathan Pryke is the director of the Pacific Islands Program at the Lowy Institute, an independent Sydney-based policy and research organization. He says Chinese state media has tried to blame Canberra and Wellington for the forum's problems.
I don't think China will greatly benefit from this departure, but I'm sure they will try to use any schisms that they see in the region to try and form wedges between Pacific nations and their traditional partners like Australia and New Zealand. We've already seen commentary from the Global Times blaming Australia and New Zealand for the fallout of the forum in the last week.
The dispute comes as the Pacific faces some of its greatest challenges, including COVID-19, which has devastated the tourism industry and threats posed by climate change. Much of the Pacific has remained free of the coronavirus, but its impact on global travel has inflicted huge economic damage on island nations that have been so reliant on tourism. The Pacific Islands Forum strives to create a region of peace, harmony and prosperity. But the loss of almost a third of its membership will strike a damaging blow to this unique institution that seeks to bring together some of the world's most remote communities. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Making headlines in Asia, Xinjiang's Communist Party says British Broadcasting Corporation's report about possible sexual abuse of Uyghur women in internment camps was totally inconsistent with facts. The BBC reported detailed alleged abuses via first-hand accounts by formerly incarcerated Uyghur Muslims. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, with in-person coaching being off the table due to the COVID pandemic, hundreds of companies nationwide are using virtual reality training to help employees master some essential skills. Maxim Moskalkov has the skills, and he has the story.
Because of the pandemic, HR specialists have faced the unique challenge of how to train new employees and staff during this time of remote work. Some companies are turning to virtual reality simulators like Mersion.
Mersion is a virtual reality simulator that allows people to practice and perfect the really challenging conversations that they have at work. The conversations that go on between a doctor and a patient, or a doctor and the family of a patient, for example.
Virtual reality can put a person in unorthodox situations that are hard to recreate in real life, and then lets them learn from their own behavior. Methods like this have been especially effective for training teachers.
To master those techniques on if you will, digital avatars, fake kids, if you think of it that way, kids who behave like the real kids in the real world, but allow them to make mistakes and do no harm, right? If they make a terrible mistake in a practice lesson in Mersion, nothing happens.
Among the first schools that resorted to virtual reality technology were the Aurora District Public Schools in Colorado. The district's chief academic officer, Andrew Wright, says the schools employ a unique approach in teacher training.
We need practice for threat assessments and having difficult situations with parents and having to share news from our threat assessment team as well as our counselors and social workers. Let's embed that into their practice and see how well it helps prepare them for some of those.
Live in Their World is a New York company that offers ethical norms and training sessions for various companies' employees with the help of virtual reality. Live in Their World founder Robin Rosenberg says virtual reality can unite people, which is especially important during a pandemic.
There are VR companies out there that can bring people together so everyone feels like they're in the same conference room, so that they're in, you know, a room looking at objects together, manipulating objects for collaboration, you know, for whiteboard, for a theater, all kinds of applications. And it can be incredibly powerful for people, particularly if they live alone.
One big downside to the technology is that VR headsets and other technology aren't as common as home computers, and tech support can be much more challenging. But for those who can get access, proponents say it's a great way to train for real life in these times of social distancing. Maxim Moskalkov for VOA News, Washington.
Now on VOA Asia, when Helio Oliva was forced to close down his quesadilla stand in Los Angeles because of the COVID pandemic, he thought he had lost everything. But instead of giving up, Oliva found a way not only to stay on his feet, but to help and feed the community hit hard by the crisis. Genia DeLow has the story.
Helio Oliva opened his quesadilla stand in East Hollywood in 2019, and within weeks it became incredibly popular. But when the coronavirus pandemic struck in mid-March, accompanied by lockdown measures, Leyva was forced to shut down. Without income, Leyva had no money to pay the rent, and his family faced eviction. That's when Leyva decided he had nothing to lose and started a GoFundMe account.
It was such an emergency because if we didn't pay the rent that month, we would be, I mean, technically homeless because we didn't have no food, we had no... I mean, it was catastrophic. But the reaction to the public to our GoFundMe was so great. And since they donated like 7,000 or 5,000 initially, and so we have like a couple of rents now. And so we felt that through that, we had a sort of like a commitment to pay back the community. Because people love what we're doing, and so we started going more into doing more cookouts.
Next, Leyva reached out to a newly formed Instagram group, Los Angeles Community Fridges, and set up a neighborhood refrigerator. Anyone could leave food in that fridge, and anyone in need could help themselves. Leyva himself started cooking free lunches once a week. With the help of volunteers, the lunches are distributed to the needy.
You know, what's better than a hot meal? You know, I know personally when I'm not feeling well, if someone drops some soup over to me, like, not only does it warm my body, but it does warm my spirit. You know, it's one less thing that I have to think about.
Today's menu is fried chicken or beef with rice, salad, avocado, and cheese. Since Leyva started organizing these community cookouts, he has made over 3,500 hot meals for those who need them. He admits it's impossible to help everyone, but he is doing what he can.
And all the things that people are experiencing with COVID, such as, you know, isolation and not being able to talk to your neighbor and distrust and hate towards the government and all that kind of stuff. When people wait in line and then they get this food, it is just this kind of beacon of hope. And people smile and they have, you know, such a thankful experience, you know, getting food here. So that's what it is. It's more about that hope that we give to people to go through the next day, you know.
Genia Dulo for VOA News, Los Angeles, California.
We invite you back for more VOA Asia at the same time tomorrow. In the meantime, join us online at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. You'll also find our full-length programs at our website, voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our team, Managing Editor Diane Gao, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Hybels. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a super day ahead. Be safe. Be well.